Well, we appreciate the presence of each one this afternoon. I'll tell you what, that was a feast. It was delicious food. We appreciate everybody that contributed to that and everybody that was able to participate in the meal. It was just wonderful. When I got to Alicia's pie, it just kind of reminded me of the holidays. Such a good amount and great food. Glad that Carrie made it back this afternoon. Good to see her back there. I want to continue the lesson that I began this morning. Governor Pilate, he found Jesus innocent. We started in Mark 15 and verse 1 where the Jews delivered Jesus up to Pilate. And we spent the morning hour discussing the various questions that Pilate asked during the period of examination. The trial itself, he had quite a few of them. We listed about 15 of them this morning. And they covered quite a bit of territory. And he was really trying to find something, some evidence, something. But he could not find any because there was none to be found. This afternoon, I want us to begin this lesson discussing several things that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John tell us that he declared, he affirmed. Not only was he in the business of asking questions in the examination, but he said some things. He declared some things. He affirmed some things during the course of that trial. Some of these, true, at least one of them is only, well, it's false because it was a compound affirmation, part of which was true and part of which was false. So it winds up being a false statement. And in fact, that's the one I want to begin with this afternoon from Matthew 27 and verse 24. After he'd gone through just about everything to go through, and he could not convince the Jews to let him release Jesus, he said, "I am innocent of the blood of this righteous man." Now, as I say, that's composed of two parts. The first part is, "I am innocent," which is false. The second part of that was, of course, it was a true description of Jesus. So not only does he wind up saying that he doesn't find fault, but he declares him the highest official before whom Jesus stood. He declares him. And the man's not a Jew. He's not a man looking for the kingdom. He's not a man that studies the Old Testament law of Moses. But he says that man is righteous. My goodness. What an official affirmation from somebody like Pilate. It's incredible. And Jesus, of course, God knew he was going to say it. God knew that that would be a part of the record. And God wanted us to know that. That somebody that's outside the covenant, somebody that's there standing in the official status of a governor, says not just that Jesus was a good man and Jesus was an innocent man, but he says Jesus Christ was righteous. But the other part, where he declares himself, it's like a pontification. This is the way that I want history written. This is how, the way that I want the case to be remembered, thought about. How's that, Pilate? That I had nothing to do with his death. I am innocent of his blood. And you remember he washed his hand, had some water brought out. Had a bowl or a basin of water brought out and he washed his hands. He gives a demonstration, a physical demonstration of a moral quality that he claims. But the moral quality that he claimed was misapplied. Because he caved in, he was not innocent. But when he said that, you know, the Jews said, well, they did not know what they were saying there. Let his blood be on us. We don't care if you're innocent of this so-called righteous man's blood. Say what you want to say. Do what you want to do. Just let us have him. Let his blood be on us and our children. And I think we understand as we look at the time this side of the cross up to 2020. That part of their wish is still being granted. They did not know what they were saying in the aftermath that would flow from that. And so, in Luke 23 and verse 4, he says, I find no fault in this man. I find no fault in this man. He had close examination. He had hostile witnesses who had opportunities to find evidence to support their accusations. None of it was worth anything. So Jesus Christ, he says, there is no fault in him. And then in Luke 23 and verse 14, he says, Behold, I, having examined him before you, found no fault in this man, touching the things whereof ye accuse him. Now how specific is that? Every charge that you brought against him, and you know, they brought several charges regarding him. But he says, every one of those things that you brought up, I found absolutely worthless. There was no evidence to support the claim. But then you have, of course, all of the evidence in the New Testament supporting the claims of Jesus. And all of the evidence supporting the claims of Bible inspiration. You have Jesus judged guilty by the Jews, judged righteous by Pilate. You have people today, many of whom denounce the Bible. It's not God's Word. They denounce Jesus. He's not the Son of God. Even if they believe in God, sometimes they just don't believe in Jesus or the Bible. So it's an incredible, incredible mix of ignorance with some knowledge that people have. But he says, I have found no fault regarding anything that you accused him of. And then number four, in Luke 23:15, he says, I know this. What do you know? I sent him to Herod, and Herod sent him back, and Herod found nothing wrong with him. Now there was a second witness. Isn't that something? Now he's not judging this on the basis of the law of Moses. But in the law of Moses, you know, you had every word established at the mouth of two or three witnesses. But here under Roman law, it's not quite like that. But I'm simply saying there are at least two outside officials, Pilate and Herod, and neither one of them found anything wrong with him. And so then, in Luke 23:22, Pilate said the third time, Why, what evil hath he done? I have found no cause of death in him. He kept on saying it. It was always true. The times that he repeated it didn't make it more true. But he just kept on saying it. They kept on denying it. And at least for quite a while, he just kept on refuting it. Yes, he's guilty. No, he's not. He did this or this. No, he did not. I have found none. And three times, he says, three times, a Roman official declares the ultimate innocency, righteousness, and faultlessness of Jesus Christ, who claimed to be the Son of God. Those are his affirmations. And they were remarkable for the ground they cover. Now finally, we have several passages in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that don't come out simply as affirmations or and certainly not as questions. That sometimes there's a little bit of overlapping here. But sometimes it's just stated as a matter of what he understood or what he perceived, what he knew. For example, in Mark 15:10, Matthew 27:18, the text says that he knew that for envy the Jews delivered him up. Now, we're not told that he ever says that during the trial. But the Bible writers tell us that down in his heart, somehow, some way, he reached that conclusion. Jesus was not here on trial for anything wrong that he did. He was here on trial because these religious leaders, these chief priests and Pharisees, they're envious of Jesus. Now, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John do not tell us how he reached that conclusion. If there was something that passed before them as he came outside the praetorium and listened to them back and forth, you know, or he watched their demeanor, their body language, if he just got a little hint here and there, or if he had heard something from somebody else, we're not told how the information got into his mind. But the conclusion that he reached was correct. This is not a matter of honor. It's not a matter of criminality. It's not a matter of anybody doing anything wrong, except their motivation, their intention. Why are they doing this? They're envious of Jesus. Now you think about that. You think about the righteous Jesus standing inside the praetorium and the hypocritical Jews on the outside who are envious of him, bringing false charges against him, on which they later, at least they put him to death and justified in their own minds. Who can stand before envy? Solomon once asked. It's a dangerous motivation. People do all kinds of mean things, ugly things, desperate things, volatile things, violent things because of envy. Terrible, terrible. And you're willing to put somebody to death because of your envy? How can a man, how can a religious man, how can a religious teacher sink that low? I think there are people in the churches of Christ from the 20th and 21st centuries that are going to have to answer for things like that. It's not that they ever committed murder, but that what they did was because of envy. I had a man who later became one of my enemies, who at the time that he told me this was still my friend. He was a preacher. And when he was talking about our situation in the church and the way that some of the preachers were starting to treat us, he said to me one day, he said, "No doubt envy is a part of this." Now he could see it. He saw it. Envy. And you know, not a whole lot of time passed before he jumped in too. Became an enemy. Well, I don't know that it was because of envy, but he could see it in others. Some of this has to do with envy. Jesus Christ was put to death. Pilate said, "They want you dead because they are envious of you." It's horrible to think about that. And then in Matthew 27:19, and I want you to turn there with me, he knew what his wife said. He knew what his wife said. This is the most curious thing. He was having to put these things together. And we're not told the background of all of this, the details of all of this, but it's just the most interesting thing, a feature of the scene. Now, he knew that for envy they delivered him up, verse 18, Matthew 27:19. And while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, "Have thou nothing to do with that righteous man?" Is that why he called Jesus that later? That's what she told me. And that's what I perceived. Maybe that gave him double confidence in his affirmation there. That righteous man. "Have thou nothing to do with that righteous man? For I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him." And then that's the end of that scene. Moves on to other matters. Now isn't that curious? That somehow she put some things together, a dream that she had had, and in the aftermath of the dream, she has some feelings and some curiosities and experiences, I guess, this mood of warning. Good night, there is much at stake here. There's more to this. This is no regular criminal. This is not a usual case, and my husband needs to be warned. And he knows that. He knows what he's heard from his wife about that righteous man. And something has troubled her. "I've suffered many things this day in a dream because of him." Very unusual. Very unusual. And so that's number two. He knew what his wife said. And evidently became a part of this, his feelings about the whole thing. And it just seems to be in the, you know, the accumulation of these facts. These things, they're just building and building, and he's having more and more trouble finding anything wrong with Jesus. And then number three, from Matthew 27, 24, and Luke 23, 23, he knew that he was getting to the point in the trial when he prevailed nothing. He prevailed nothing. And Matthew says, a tumult was arising. The feelings and the outcry of the Jews outside the Praetorium was escalating. They're not just a passive, tranquil group of people. They're just waiting for a verdict. This thing is becoming more like a mob. You remember the town clerk in Acts 19 at Ephesus trying to quiet the mob down. We're in danger this day because of the way this has turned out. Rome's going to hear about this. We're in danger of this. You people need to quieten down. This group of people that have brought Jesus, their mood is dire, their feelings are intense, and things are now starting to get out of control. It's starting to become a mob. He knew he prevailed nothing. And in Luke's account, in chapter 23, 23, he says, when Pilate was trying to get them to let him turn Jesus loose, they wouldn't do it. And he says, their voices prevailed. He knew what was happening. And he knew that he was in a bind. And he knew that he was caving in. He knew that. Sad, sad thing. And number four, from John 19, verses 12 through 16, he knew just as surely as he stood there before that group of Jews, he did not want to forfeit the favor of Caesar. You know, they finally told him in John 19, 12 through 16, we have no king but Caesar, which was a bald-faced, hypocritical declaration. Imagine Jews trying to admit, oh, our king is Caesar. They couldn't stand Caesar. They couldn't stand Roman power. That's why publicans had such a rough time in collecting taxes, taking Jewish taxes and giving it to the Romans. Does that sound right for God's covenant people to lose funds to pagans? The only people in Palestine that would favor and help to some degree the government would be the Herodians. But I would dare to say most of the Jewish men were not Herodians. Some of them were, but most of them I would think would not be. But when they said, we have no king but Caesar, and if you release him, you are not Caesar's friend. That struck such a political chord in his heart. He knew he could not stand to forfeit the favor of Caesar. Politics! Politics! When I was very, very young, I was more naive than I am now. I'm still naive. I don't know how you ever get over being naive. But boy, when I was young, I was extraordinarily naive, and I didn't realize we had politics in the church. I couldn't see that. I couldn't think that brethren acted like, you know, just people out in the world that, you know, throw power around and abuse people by power. I couldn't see it when I was just a little kid. Of course, I was sheltered. I was just in a little bitty area, you know, and my sphere was very small. But then I grew up very naive about that sort of thing. It took a while for me to be banged into a realization that we have people that play politics in the church, and some of the worst are gospel preachers. But here's old Pilate playing politics. I am here because of Caesar. I have this job because of Caesar. I can't forfeit Caesar's friendship and Caesar's favor. That's sort of the way that some preachers do their work. I've just got to have somebody's favor. Oh, it doesn't have to be God's. It's got to be somebody down here that I can depend on for my paycheck or for my security or whatever it is. I need somebody here whose favor I can court. And I'll court it. He did not want to forfeit the friendship and favor of Caesar. Remember John 12, 42 and 43, Jesus had said, this was regarding Jews. There were some people that John records for us. There were some people during Jesus' ministry, some of the Jews, some of the chief priests, rulers of the Jews, who believed on him. They believed he was the Son of God. But because of the Pharisees, they would not confess it, lest they should be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the glory that is of men more than the glory that is of God. Now everybody's got to make his choice in life. It's not just the Jews. It's not just Pilate. Every one of us has to decide for himself which selection he'll make. Do I want God's favor more than I want man's? Or do I want man's favor more than I want God's? We all have to make that decision. Whenever we became a Christian, we were telling others and ourselves, I've made mine. I seek the glory of God. I stand with God. I stand with Christ. God being my helper, I'll do that until I die. But everybody has to make the choice. It's like Paul says in Galatians 1, am I seeking the favor of men or of God? If I were seeking to please men, he said, I would not be a Christian. So you make your choice. And Pilate makes his on this sad day. And then number 5, he knew, Mark 15:15, he wanted to content the multitude. That's what we're told. And he knew he wanted to. I'm here in a bind. I want to turn Jesus loose. Luke 23:20, he wanted to turn him loose. But because it was turning into a mob scene, and because he wanted to make them happy, he finally turned Jesus over for crucifixion. Sad, sad thing. We can say it like this. He surrendered principle to pressure. That's the choice we've been talking about. Glory of men, glory of God. Pilate had the opportunity of doing the right thing, but he did the wrong thing. He did the thing that God knew he would do. He did something that was very useful to me, but it was self-condemnatory on his own part. And instead of being honorable and following the principles of the case and the evidence where it led, instead of standing by his own verdict of innocent, he allowed their unjust verdict of guilty to carry because he wanted to make them happy. He wanted them to go away. And so he turned Jesus over for crucifixion. It's interesting because later, John 19:22, when they're out there, the soldiers and the Jews are out there crucifying Jesus and having raised him up on that cross, and now there it stands, no doubt in a hole, and he's suspended between heaven and earth, and they see that superscription on that board above his head. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And they see that up there. And some of them come back to Pilate. Say, Pilate, don't say that. Now, it was near enough a row of people passing by that a lot of the Jews could see Jesus suspended and read that superscription. So they say, don't say that. you need to write something else up there. You say, he said he was the king of the Jews. And so Pilate, the man who had already surrendered principle to pressure, said, in effect, that's as far as I go, which was way too far. That's as far as I go with you people. What I have written, I have written. I'm not fooling with you people anymore. It stands. And it did. He finally rose to a moment of integrity after the deal was struck, after the cowardice was on display, after the compromise was reached, after he caved in. Finally, he comes to a point of honor. What I have written, I've written. You're not pushing me any further. I tell you what, the trial was something. And in the trial, we do at least have these things to consider. And there's a lot of detail in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Though they don't emotionally supply the information, they're not allowed as Bible writers just to stop at any given point and just cry over what's happening and spill their emotions on the pages. But in the absence of all of that, we have a lot of intriguing detail regarding Governor Pilate, the man who found Jesus innocent. If you're here this afternoon and not a Christian, come in faith, repent of your sins, make the good confession, be baptized into Christ. If you've done that and gone astray, we encourage you to come home right now. While together we stand, while we sing, won't you come?